Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here as we talk today about tracking viruses in deep water supply wells to protect our drinking water. And since, I think, 2007, Ken Bradbury and his colleagues from the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey, along with specialists from the U.S. Geological Survey and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, have been finding and studying viruses in deep water supply wells. Talking about it today with Ken Bradbury. He heads the hydrology program at the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. And Tom Hakenen, who manages the Madison Water Utility and been a part of that program, a part of this research program, not the whole part, but certainly a significant part. So we're glad to have him with us, too, to talk about it. And it's something most of us, I guess, probably don't think too much about, viruses in our water supply, and especially in deep water well supplies. Well, we're going to find out what they've been finding, and you can join in with your questions and comments as we move along today. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. And Ken, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry.
And Tom Hakenen, good to have you here for the first time.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being with us. What prompted you to conduct your studies in the first place, Ken Bradbury?
Well, Larry, a few years ago, we received some funding from a consortium of water utilities to look at transport of different sort of disease-causing organisms in groundwater. One of the things we looked at was viruses. Now, viruses have rarely, if ever, been found in deep wells. And so the folks, when we started looking at this, people said, well, you're crazy to even look for these because you're not going to find them. And so we kind of took a shot in the dark, and we sampled, since we were here in Madison, we sampled water from several of the deep wells in Madison, and we're very surprised that we did find viruses. And these are what are called human enteric viruses, which means they're specific to humans. They don't come from dogs or cats or deer or other animals. We were so surprised that we replicated that work and did it all over again and got the same results. So in the years since then, we've continued this work and have been finding these viruses with some regularity in most of the Madison wells that we've sampled. And I want to point out that Madison, as Tom will tell you, chlorinates their water, so the viruses are disinfected before they get out to the homeowners. And so the interesting things to us is, how did these viruses, which, because they come from people, originated at the land surface, how did they get down into the deep aquifer, which is
long ways down,
800, 900 feet below the surface? So that's a thing we're studying now.
Tom, were you surprised?
Very surprised. It kind of goes against conventional thinking about groundwater transport and how fast it gets to where it goes. So, we were very surprised. As Ken said, though, our treatment processes inactivate these viruses very well. So from a health standpoint, it's not a risk. But just understanding how this happens is a very interesting process.
Well, how does that? Yeah, you wonder, how the heck does a virus get from the top of the ground 800 feet down and through, what, soil, obviously, and shale and everything else?
Right. Well, we have, as you say, we have soil. We have a layer of shale. The aquifer is mostly sandstone. And it is true, if we use conventional hydrogeologic thinking and equations, groundwater should only be moving a few feet a year, and getting the viruses down there within their lifespan of a couple of years is almost impossible. So we have to think about things like fractures in the rock, places where there are openings or voids, or even places where well casings might be leaking or failing or something like that. I also want to just mention that even though, you know, we've been doing this work in Madison because we are in Madison and our survey's here, but we're not you know, trying to point any fingers at Madison or anything like that. I suspect that other cities that use deep groundwater would have this, pretty much the same kind of problem. We suspect, by the way, that the source of the viruses are probably our own sewer system here, which typical of many Midwestern cities is old, probably leaks, and is, you know, and we have sampled the sewers, and they're, of course, as you might expect, they are loaded with these human viruses. So that's a logical source.
What are the viruses? What viruses are you tracking?
Well, there are things like norovirus, rotavirus. They're the same kind of viruses that make people sick on, say, on these cruise ships. When you hear about a cruise ship and everyone getting stomach upset and so forth, and those kinds of things. And there's a whole there are a number of different ones. And we the laboratory which we've used, and my colleague Mark Borkhardt up at Marshfield is the analyst. Is able to speciate these viruses so that we know what kind they are and whether they're actually infectious or not. Remember, viruses are not technically alive. They're little packets of genetic material that have to have a living host in order to replicate, and these viruses are specific to humans, as I mentioned.
Yeah. And so, well, they're technically not alive?
They're technically not living things. They require a human host to replicate. So they're kind of in that netherworld between living and not living, I guess.
Tom, so what does chlorine do to them then? They're not alive to begin with.
Chlorine is a very strong oxidant. It basically rips electrons away from things. And so it destroys their structure.
Okay, so it just breaks the structure up.
It breaks the structure up, yeah.
So they can't... they don't reform.
They can't replicate. Yeah. So if we sample in different ways, or we test in different ways. Sometimes we just find pieces of what you might call dead or disactivated virus, pieces of their genetic material. When we find that, then we also test to see if they're infectious, meaning can they replicate? And the laboratory has some ways of doing that. And they're not always infectious, but sometimes they are. And the infectious ones are the ones that would make people sick.
You know, as I think about this, how many deep water wells do we have here in Wisconsin, and are they all chlorinated?
That's a really excellent question. Well, there are thousands of deep wells. Most cities do chlorinate, but not all. So there are places in Wisconsin where there are community water supplies, and these are usually the smaller towns that up to now have not been required to disinfect. There's chlorination is not the only kind of disinfection people use. But largely based on our work and the work of my colleague Mark Borkhardt up at Marshfield, the DNR has now passed some new rules requiring disinfection of public water supplies.
I would, I think that'd be a good, I think most citizens would be in favor of that.
I think so, too. And, of course, there is a cost to communities to do that, but I think most people would favor and have favored that approach.
Well, let's take some calls. By the way, you can join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Ron in Blooming Grove, we'll go to you. Ron, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks. It's been almost 30 years since I took groundwater hydrology, but I sat in on a few seminars since. I understand some of our wells in Madison are 1,300 feet deep. My main point about virus transport is how far down is the cone of depression? If you measure these wells, the pressure when they're pumping at maximum discharge, for example, when they were fighting the big butter and cheese warehouse fire back in 91, I think it was.
Yeah.
When you had those wells pumping at maximum power, how far down did the water level, the pressure level in the confined aquifer, did it drop 10 feet or did it drop 1,000 feet? And if it drops a significant amount, that can explain how a virus has been transported more than 2 feet in a year. If the surface, the pressure surface, not necessarily the water table surface, but the pressure surface in the confined aquifer dropped 300 feet, then viruses that had been at the surface could be sucked down a great deal. Thanks.
All right. Well, Ken Bradbury, yeah, go to you.
Yeah, I think I can address some of that. The caller is correct. There is a cone of depression as the wells pump. The amount of the cone of depression is something on the order of 60 feet or 60, 70 feet in the middle of Madison. It's certainly not 300 feet nor 1,000 mm-hmm. feet. But he's quite right that when the wells are pumping, that creates what's called a downward hydraulic gradient. In other words, the water wants to move downward toward those wells because you're reducing the pressure down on the deep aquifer. And that's what pulls water down. But the velocity or the speed that they travel also depends on the material they have to go through. And even under a big gradient, they still have to go through the sand and gravel or the sandstone or whatever. Yeah. And so understanding what those passageways and what that rock is like is what we're trying to do and find out how fast they can move. If there are fractures or voids, the water can move pretty quickly.
Yeah. Do we have a way of knowing how much, you know, for example, he used the example of the big fire that occurred in 91. Do we have any way of knowing how far the aquifer would drop or how the water?
Well, I think Tom can correct me if I'm wrong, but the water utility measures the depth of water in the wells fairly often.
Okay.
And they have quite a good idea of what the pumping level, you know, when the well is off, there's what's called the static water level. And then when it's pumping, the water level drops, and that's measured pretty regularly.
I think. Tom?
Yes. Well, we can only pump a well so hard. I mean, the pump has a certain capacity. Our pumps are typically 2,400 gallons a minute. So, generally, the specific capacities are fairly high here. So, the drawdown is not that tremendous, as Ken said, and then it really doesn't matter, you know, if we're pumping hard and we have a lot of wells supplying an emergency like that fire he mentioned, it's really not going to change dramatically the amount of drawdown that we see.
Let's go to Margaret in La Crosse next. Margaret, hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning.
Morning.
I certainly am a proponent of clean water and believe in protecting our aquifer, but I wonder if our scientists there would have any information on maybe an unintended consequence of our use of chlorine. I read recently that there is a negative effect on our skin if we're sitting in bath water that's chlorinated, especially for babies. Do you run across that kind of study, or do you look at those kinds of things in the way we use chlorine in our daily lives?
Mm-hmm. Well, sure. The main public health concern with chlorination is disinfection byproducts, byproducts that form when chlorine is added to the water. These are very low in our water supply here in Madison, and I imagine they would be in most groundwater supplies, where the organic matter in the source water is very low. So what happens with chlorination byproducts is that they're mainly a concern where you have organic carbon in the water, like lake water, mm-hmm. those kinds of things, tannins and so forth, and that can be pretty high. And it's also affected by water temperature, and our groundwater, of course, is constantly pretty cool at around 55 degrees. So chlorination byproducts measure very, very low here. We're well under the health standards for those. And also, because our source water is fairly clean, we don't need to add much chlorine. Our residual chlorine in the system is less than a half a part per million. So we really don't have any concerns about chlorination. I mean, and the benefits of it are tremendous.
What are the benefits, aside from the virus?
Well, aside from the virus, there's the bacteria that may be in the water that might enter the water at any point along its distribution to the home. Typically, there is no problem with contamination of the water in the system because it's all under pressure. And any water movement would be out of the system and not in. But there are possibilities where if there's a water main break, you might have a very momentary situation where the pressure is near zero. And having that chlorine residual in the system just is an insurance policy. It protects against any possible contamination that might occur.
Yeah. Anything to add to that, Ken?
Well, yeah, just I in my opinion, I think chlorination is one of the biggest public health benefits of the last 100 years, probably. It's if you think about if you go to Mexico or Europe and you know, you worry about drinking the water, there are a few places in the United States where you really have to worry about getting sick from the water, and that's because we have chlorination. And I know the water utility is very careful to add just enough chlorine because, you know, they get complaints from people who, like this woman who has called, worrying about if it has an odor or what high levels might be. And it is true that high levels are not good for you, but enough having this residual in the pipes to kill any bacteria is really what they're shooting for, and they monitor that very carefully.
Thanks again for calling, Margaret. Talking with Professor Ken Bradbury, who heads the hydrology program at the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey, and Tom Hakkinen, who's manager of the Madison Water Utility, visiting about our water supply and about tracking viruses in our deep water supply wells to protect our drinking water. Join us with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi.
Talking about water today and about some of the research that's been done to look at viruses in deep water well supplies. Ken in Mayville has a question for our two guests, by the way, Ken Bradbury and Tom Hakkinen, our guests. Ken in Mayville, on to you. Thank you for calling.
I was just wondering if this is a issue that they're finding only with big cities and stuff due to the sewer system, like he had said, or is it a problem that they believe might be even in rural wells? Have they tested any of the rural wells at all?
Another good question.
Yeah, good question. Actually, the folks at the Marshfield Clinic and the USDA have tested quite a few rural wells and indeed have found viruses in some of them. Now, it's because rural wells in general are much shallower than these municipal wells that we're talking about here in Madison, it's a little less of a surprise to find them there. On the other hand, the virus load in rural areas seems to be a lot lower. You don't have these major sewers and the population pressure that you do in a city. And so although the viruses are found in rural wells occasionally, it doesn't seem to be as a major problem for domestic wells.
All right, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. Anne in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm here. I'm in Milwaukee, and I'm happy to be listening to these gentlemen who we owe a great debt of gratitude to for taking care of us. We look at and love and drink Lake Michigan. We take care of it. But when there's horrific rain and snow and we need to dump some of that snow into the lake, you know, some of us boil our water.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, is 2 minutes enough?
Oh,
you've done all your good stuff. Now, what do we need?
Cryptosporidium kinds of issues there.
Right.
Tom?
2 minutes should be good. Really, as long as you get that temperature up to boiling, which is 212 degrees, and 2 to 5 minutes would be sufficient.
Yeah. So there you go. Thanks, Ann.
Just one little quick question.
Sure.
Before that, some of us drain it through charcoal. You know those deals you get.
Yeah.
Burel. Is that for solid matter?
The charcoal is not going to. The charcoal would probably take out organics,
right?
But it wouldn't. I don't think it's going to take out the crypto mm-hmm. or bacteria. So,
but it's worth doing.
If you're worried about something like taste or odor, it's probably worth doing. It all depends on what's in your water, and you're over in Milwaukee.
Mm-hmm.
The Milwaukee Water Utility would be the place to find out what's in the water there.
Okay.
But it does bring up the point, though, that different treatments, these home treatments, are going to take out different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always important for people to read the instructions or the specifications of any kind of home treatment device you have and make sure you understand what it's doing, because they all do different things.
Yeah. Is boiling going to take a virus out?
Boiling would, which should disinfect a virus, yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Thanks,
well,
Ann.
One more thing on the carbon is that it will remove chlorine. Any additional remaining chlorine in the water will be removed by that charcoal or activated carbon, as it's known.
Okay. There you go. Thanks again, Ann, for calling. Bob in Middleton, let's go to you now. Hi, Bob.
Hi there. I thought that the recharge area for these aquifers here in Madison and Middleton was way up to the north, tens of miles away. And so presumably these viruses are not coming in at the recharge area. Is that right?
Well, actually, no. The recharge area is all around us. And that's one point that I try to make over and over again, that any time you see water falling on the land surface, it's going to be recharge around here. So recharge is coming from right around the wells, and some of it's coming from a little farther away too, but it's not miles and miles away. It's fairly close.
So this is not coming down the geologic gradient, I mean, with the dip of the rocks, the aquifers themselves?
Well, that contributes a little bit, but mostly it has to do with topography and elevation here in Wisconsin. So recharge happens right nearby, and that's an important concept because it means that what we do on the surface near our wells is going to control our own water quality, and we don't have to worry about what's happening in some distant place.
Okay, I see. That's news to me. Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Bob. And Helen in Bayville has a question for you guys. Hi, Helen.
Hello.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was just wondering. I've been hearing there's been a lot out there about fracking for oil. And when somebody said, cracks in the rocks, I thought, oh, well, I'm reasonably sure from some maps that have been flashed before my face on the television screen, that there is some of this fracking for gas going on in our area.
And now Bayville is...
No, in the area that you're speaking about.
Oh, okay.
Well, actually, no, I don't think there is no petroleum or natural gas production in Wisconsin. There is fracking that goes on there, and for people that don't know, what she's talking about is called, what they hear is called fracking or hydrofracking, involves pumping water down a well with very high pressure to the point where it actually cracks the rocks, and it allows fluids to flow into the well better through these cracks. That's been done for years in central Wisconsin, where the aquifers are not as good. Fracking has been a pretty common technique to increase water well yields. It's been in the news recently in kind of a negative way because it's fracking is used to look for these gas shales in, for instance, in upstate New York, and that's been a new petroleum source for the country. Those are done in very deep petroleum wells, and there's been some concern that's causing some contamination there. And it's been in the news quite a lot. That's not happening in Wisconsin because we don't have any petroleum resources here.
Wow, there we go. Thank you again for calling. But an email from Robert, and this sort of relates to the charcoal filter question. Does the use of home water filters remove virus particles and residual chlorine? Are there any home water filters that don't use charcoal? Charcoal takes out the chlorine, you were saying earlier.
Charcoal does. You'd have to check with the particular product you're using. I don't know everything that's on the market there. I think many of them do use activated carbon as part of the filter. It's not the whole filter. It's just part of the filter. The other part of the question was viruses removal. That depends on the filter, I think, and you'd have to check with the product literature on that.
Okay, but would charcoal remove
viruses?
No, it would not.
No, viruses are. I think of them as a very small, very very small particle, and so it takes a very fine filter to remove them.
Jack in Minnesota City, Minnesota. Let me say that again. Jack in Minnesota City, Minnesota. We go to you now. Hi, Jack.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, you were talking about wondering how the viruses are getting into the water, and I've been listening here for a while, and I heard you say that wells get checked for the depth of the water in the well frequently.
Yes.
I was wondering if that's maybe how the viruses are getting in there, is from the checking of the depths of the well itself.
That's an interesting question, okay. Tom. Let's go to Tom first, I guess. Tom Aikinen?
These are checked with instruments that are already in there, so it's not as though one has to lean over a hole and do anything or like.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I second that. It's, you know, I think the people that the instruments and the people that do it are trained and are quite careful not to introduce anything into the well. That's always a concern, you know.
It is a good question
when you're doing anything with the well, that you don't somehow contaminate it or drop something into it. And so I know particularly the utility or people are probably more careful than most about that. So yeah. I don't think that's the issue.
All right. Thank you again for calling. And we have some open lines we can get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions. Carl in Houston, Minnesota. We'll go to you now. Hi, Carl.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for a great show. It's very educational. I had a question. You know how you can go to the grocery stores and buy that water that's been purified by reverse osmosis? I was wondering if your speakers could, you know, address that a little bit, whether that gets the bacteria and viruses out or if that water's healthy to drink. And that's my question. I can take it off there.
All right. Thank you.
Tom? Sure. Reverse osmosis is the finest level of removal that you can achieve with water treatment. So
what happens? what's going on with reverse osmosis?
Well, it's basically filtration under fairly high pressures to move water across a membrane, which is permeable to a very, very small degree. So, yes, viruses can be removed with reverse osmosis. You can almost produce distilled water with reverse osmosis. Is it safe to drink? Sure. It probably won't taste very good. I mean, natural waters have minerals in them, and all these things help to contribute to what we think of as good tasting water. So it's a matter. Water taste is a matter of personal preference, but certainly reverse osmosis, if you're concerned about those sorts of things, would remove the most wide ranging list of contaminants.
Okay, there we go. Thank you for that. And let's go to Mona in Appleton has another question relating to reverse osmosis. Hi, Mona.
Hi. Yeah, I'm just wondering on the reverse osmosis filters, if you're using water from there that was taken from that system, and it's leaving spots on glass. If you're misting like an aquarium or something, it's leaving spots.
Is it doing its job? Oh, well, that's another good question, because those spots would probably be like, under most circumstances, would be like minerals, I assume, wouldn't they, Ken?
I expect it'd be calcium, magnesium, or hardness.
Well, I think it would depend on the exact type of membrane that's being used in the RO filtration process. Some may be designed to remove even those cations, but some may not. You'd have to look into what it was supposed to remove.
Yeah, so there's different gradations of reverse osmosis, you're saying, Tom.
That's right.
Okay, there you go. Thank you for calling, Mona. Let's see, we had an email from Kelly. She asks, if she sets out a container of water for a while, will the chlorine volatilize and be safer to use? Well, I don't know if it'd be any safer, but go ahead, Tom.
Well, it's not any safer, but it will definitely volatilize and come out. That's one method of removing chlorine from water if you're sensitive to that or if you don't like the taste of it. Just put it in a pitcher and set it out on your counter, and in a couple of hours it won't have any chlorine in it.
What about if you set it in your refrigerator?
Same thing, although you might want to go for several hours there because it'll be a slower process.
It's a slower process. Yeah. Okay. And Erica was emailed and wondering about the presence of chromium 6 in the water. And Tom?
Sure. So he's probably referring to the news item recently, the Environmental Working Group study that was released a week or so ago. Chromium 6 was measured in their study. They took a sample from one home in Madison and reported a value of 1.58 parts per billion. We know nothing about the location of that sample or the sampling methodology. However, it's likely that there is some chromium 6 in our water. It's naturally occurring in the rock. But what levels are out there, we don't know. That's why we're going to do some of our own testing starting next week. And we also don't know at what level is it a concern. The EPA does not regulate chromium 6 right now. The state of California is the only state in the nation that has proposed a public health goal for chromium 6. But it's our understanding that the federal government, the EPA, is doing a study and plans to release some information on this probably in the spring, summer of next year. Okay. So while there may be a drinking regulation on the horizon for chromium 6, there isn't one right now. And I'm reasonably certain or reasonably confident that chromium 6 is not going to present a problem in the Madison water supply. But we are following the science very closely, and we will certainly take any action that we need to remove it if that ends up being the case. But, you know, a part per billion is a very, very small number.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it is. Becky in Belleville, we're on to you now. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I just wanted to mention two things. One, consumer confidence reports are a good place for people to find drinking water information for public water systems. I've looked them up myself on the DNR website. You can just search for them there. And then the other thing was a question. I know there's subtle differences between a recharge area and a watershed, and I heard one of your callers mentioning that, and I wondered if you could sort of explain, probably better than I could, the difference between a watershed and a recharge area.
Okay. Ken, let's turn to you for that one.
Sure. Well, the watershed that we generally think about it is really more of a surface water feature. In other words, what's the topographic area or the area of land that where the rain and snow are going to drain into a particular lake or a river or something like that. And that's based mostly on topography. When we talk about recharge, because recharge is a process that happens underground, it doesn't necessarily always follow our topography. And it's influenced somewhat by topography, but also by the subsurface geology, by the wells that are pumping, by the different rock formations, the different soil types. And so recharge is really, as I mentioned before, is occurring pretty much everywhere. Now we can delineate the recharge areas for specific wells, for example, and figure out where the water's coming from for a specific well or for a specific feature like a spring or a lake. And that's not always the same as the surface watershed. Sometimes they're somewhat the same, but they're not necessarily the same at all.
All right. Thank you for calling. Ken in Cudahy, on to you now. Hi, Ken.
Hi. I live in Cudahy, Wisconsin, and I go to Bayview. They have an artesian spring that's been pumping water for years, and now it's pumped electrically, but that's exclusively what we drink for our drinking water. And I'm wondering if you have any knowledge of how well that's checked and if it's any good for us to drink all the time.
Okay.
I don't have any knowledge of that particular spring, and so I have no idea whether it's checked or not. I will say that You know, anytime you have a spring or an artesian well, it's just groundwater. There's nothing magical about it. It's usually pretty good quality because our groundwater in Wisconsin tends to be of good quality. But there's no, you know, it's not a, there's nothing magical about it, and it's probably not much different than the water coming out of the well down the road. So, but I'd be careful. You know, if it's a public place and somebody's in charge of it, then maybe there's been some testing. But you have to be careful that someone is testing it, because otherwise there's no assurance that you're getting, you know, bacteria-free water.
So it'd be worth checking on that.
Yeah, but I personally have no knowledge of that particular spot.
So Ken, you might want to do a little more digging and find out if there's any testing going on. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Aaron in Wonder Lake, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for calling.
Yeah, no problem. A couple comments. One, you guys were talking about the hexavalent chromium being in the water. That's also called the chromium 6. That will be effectively removed by reverse osmosis, and it should be somewhere in the high 90% rejection range, so... So that will get removed by reverse osmosis. The other comment that I had about reverse osmosis, it does remove, like I said, pretty much, you know, 90% of what's going to come through it. So it does remove taste, but you can add taste back into the water, you know, with calcite cartridges or magnesium.
Okay, so that can be done. Thank you.
No problem.
Yeah, appreciate the call. And you guys wouldn't argue with that? I don't think so.
Nope. Good point.
Put a little salt in there if you want.
You can pretty much do whatever you want with it after it's gone through the reverse osmosis process. Well, you think the water? Well, I guess what I've heard from you guys today is that you're fairly happy with the situation with our water in Madison and across the Madison. Tom, you're fairly confident and happy.
Yes, I think we do a pretty good job of keeping on track of things, and you know, if there's changes in the science and if new risks are identified, we'll jump right on it.
Yeah, and Ken, statewide.
Overall, Wisconsin has wonderful water quality. I mean, we take it for granted. But compared to other places in the world and even other places in the United States, it's a great resource we have. Here we are, just, it's something we can just pump out of the ground for almost nothing and drink. And there's not very many places in the world you can do that. So it doesn't mean we don't have to be vigilant about it, but it's a fantastic resource.
Well, it is. And as we were talking before the show, the utilities, the 584 utilities in Wisconsin, totaled 151 billion gallons of water pulled out of the ground, and that is 12% less than some years back, even though. Now, that's over the last 5 years, sales declined, the amount declined by 12%, while the number of customers served by the utilities increased by 4.5%. So another good thing is I think we're doing a better job of protecting the water that we have, and we're not using as much.
And water conservation works. It really does.
Guys, thank you so much for being with us today. Appreciate it very much. I learned a lot, and I think our listeners did too.
Thanks, Larry.
You're quite welcome.
Thank you so much. Ken Bradbury heads the hydrology program at the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey in Madison. Tom Hakenen, manager of the Madison Water Utility. I learned a lot. I hope you did too. And hopefully we can get these guys back and talk again about our water supplies. Coming up, though, we're going to take a look at words and how words are used. And we can talk about all kinds of kind of cool words with Joan Houston Hall. She is chief editor for the Dictionary of American Regional English. And if there's a word you have a question about, man, she is the person who will have a good answer for you. Joan Houston Hall, coming up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin
Public Radio.